There are few people as passionate about researching Guelph's unwritten past than author and historian Bonnie Dirtnell, and her latest book takes a detailed look at the role working people played in building many of the city's enduring traditions and characteristics. "It is working class history," said Dirtnell of her book Laboring All Our Lives. "It deals with industry, but it doesn't look at it from the perspective of the middle class or upper class owners, which was very common. Books and accounts commissioned by wealthy industrialists often overlooked the contributions and sacrifices their employees made to the cities, and their businesses, growth and success. What it looks at is such things as working conditions, accident rates in factories and hospitalization, if they got that far," she said. "It looks at women's work, child labor, and I even added chapters that weren't in the original work, touching on housing in Guelph. One chapter looks at the different waves of immigration and how that influenced the industrial expansion and cultural diversity of Guelph. From when the English and the Scots arrived and the rift between Irish Catholics and Irish Protestants that resulted in one of the major hangings in Guelph," said Dirtnell. "Some, such as newly emancipated African Americans, Chinese and European Jews came to Guelph to escape crushing poverty, wars, racial violence and political unrest in their home countries. There is a little bit about the Germans and then, of course, the major group that came here, the Italians and the Ward. The Ward is constantly popping up." Dirtnell has spent more than two decades collecting records and data, as well as interviewing people and recording first-hand accounts of what it was like to live and work in the city prior to 1950. "It was about 2004 that I put together a much smaller version of the book for the Guelph Labor Council," she said. "It covered all the way up to the present because I was insane at the time. Only four copies of the original book were printed for the Guelph Labor Council's archives." Nevertheless, Dirtnell continued to accumulate more accounts and information, including one-of-a-kind, primary documents and artifacts from the period between 1827 and 1950. A lot of the work has been posted on her website, but she felt compelled to share it more formally with the public in print. "I felt I really had to do this one," said Dirtnell. "My logic was, if I get hit with a bus tomorrow, who else would do it? There is nobody who has ever done anything on Guelph labor history in such an extensive manner." Guelph in 1827, as Dirtnell reveals, was much like other new communities sprouting up in Canada at the tail end of the Industrial Revolution. New technologies were providing new opportunities and replacing age-old traditions. "Guelph, in the early days, had dozens of blacksmiths," said Dirtnell. "A blacksmith is a craftsman. He makes everything, including your tools, your agricultural plows. Everything you need, you can get from a blacksmith, and then you have coming to Guelph, a new metal worker, and that was the foundry. Foundry owners acquired patents for molds that allowed them to mass produce the latest tools, plows, and other metal parts faster and more consistently than blacksmiths. The growth of foundries reduced the dependence on craftsmen and increased demand for cheap unskilled labor. By the early 1900s, St. Patrick's Ward, now known simply as the Ward, had become the industrial center of the city. This was largely due to the efforts of wealthy publisher James Walter Lyon, who bought much of the property between the river and York Road and offered incentives for businesses to build factories there. The remaining land was offered to private citizens and developers to build homes for factory workers. Some developers took advantage of the shortage of housing to profit at the expense of the working class. "Housing has always been a problem in Guelph for the working class," said Dirtnell. "There was already an overcrowding issue, but it depends upon which culture you are looking at. For English and Scots, it was overcrowding. For some Italians, it was just how they lived. It was a way of life, and there was nothing wrong with it. Other traditions, such as the subservient status of women and child labor, were exploited by factory owners to get cheap and, in some cases, free workers. Long after the factory laws of 1884 outlawed child labor, it remained a common practice, especially during the First and Second World Wars, when many able-bodied men were called to service. Women were also expected to take the place of men in factories during wartime, but were quickly returned to women's work, or their roles as housewives in peacetime. The definition of what was women's work has continually changed over the period," said Dirtnell. "By the 1920s, women are accepted doing clerical work. So, they would be typewriters. That's the machine, but it is also the name they originally called secretaries. The subdivision of labor allowed businesses to pay women less, and that is one reason Bell Telephone chose young women to be switchboard operators, or hello girls, as they were called in the early days. Women were considered to be more pliable, and they had better voices for talking on the phone, said Dirtnell. They were considered more pliable because they could take more crap from customers, the bosses, and everybody else. Dirtnell documents how the growth and influence of unions and organized labor played a significant role in improving the rights and working conditions of working-class women and men. Union-negotiated contracts guaranteed living wages, shorter work weeks, and other employment standards we take for granted today. They gave workers leisure time and opportunities to form organized sports clubs and other community organizations that Dirtnell calls a shadow culture. I call it a shadow culture because people in the working class would try to do everything their betters did, but they could not do it in the same way or on the same scale, she said. You couldn't afford it, but there were factory clubs and they played hockey, and baseball was the big one. The original Maple Leafs from Sleeman's were originally working-class people. Laboring All Our Lives covers Guelph's working-class history from 1827 to 1950. I was originally going to go further, but I decided I can't, said Dirtnell. My favorite period and the period I am most familiar with is right up to the end of World War II. After World War II, the world really changes again. It is tempting to think we've made great progress and look back at those simpler times with smug 2020 hindsight, but perhaps we should reserve some modesty and consider how future generations might look back at the contributions we are making with the technological resources we have now. Nearly all of the factories mentioned in Dirtnell's book have closed over the past 70 years, and few, if any, of the workers from that time are alive today. They were among several generations of workers in Guelph that made and exported products we mostly import now. Perhaps they still have lessons to teach us. I am starting on another book called We Used to Make Things in Guelph, said Dirtnell. It will be the Ward edition because I got lots of material from when Guelph began and all the way up.